as we do quantum field theory, we are interested in hard interactions at short distances. And in a laboratory setting, this is always complicated because of QCD radiation. I guess complicated depending on what you're looking for. Some people think that is the problem. Other people just think it's something to get around. But when you want to understand what's happening at short distances, this QCD radiation almost inevitably gets produced, say, at an E plus E minus collision, or even more aptly at the LHC, where you're colliding two protons, and so you're forced into a hadronic environment. And anything that you would want to learn, say, new physics, you'd have to understand the hadronic environment in which the new physics is being produced. And so getting a handle on QCD radiation is sort of imperative to get a handle on hard short distances, the hard interactions at short distances. And I guess, well, if you go to E plus E minus, then you could hope that you would tune your machine to exactly the resonant frequency at which you would see whatever the new physics is. Like you would just build an E plus E minus machine that would sit right at the Higgs mass, or you build an E plus E minus machine that would sit right at the... It is. However, if you want to look at more exclusive observables, for instance, if I'm interested in the Higgs, I would want to know more than just say its total cross-section, because you have lots of new physics that can produce the same total cross-section for the Higgs, but if you look at a more differential cross-section of the Higgs, the new physics could substantially change that. But as soon as you ask questions that are more differential, then you need things more than just a parton distribution function. You might want to look at a transverse momentum dependent parton distribution function. And as soon as you start asking questions like that, then the complications of QCD radiation can't just be solved with Altarelli-Parisi resummation of your parton distribution function. So, there's a general approach that's been used to get at the QCD radiation and constrain it, or when you have these differential constraints, and that is just factorization. And as sort of an example of factorization, I'm going to take E plus E minus, because that is a much simpler example, goes to two jets plus X. And in particular, you can constrain globally that you're in the two-jet region by measuring a quantity called the thrust. And the thrust is defined to be the quantity where I sum over all three momenta weighted against some arbitrary axis at first. Normalize to the mod of all the three momenta, and I find the axis which maximizes this quantity thrust. Once I have found what maximizes this quantity thrust, I then calculate something else that people also call thrust, confusingly. One minus thrust is also thrust, which is just the vagaries of the literature over which I have absolutely no control. But having found this thrust axis, I get the quantity thrust, and so then I calculate thrust, and by demanding this to be much, much less than one, I'm in the two-jet region. And that's sort of easy to understand. If I draw a little cartoon, say this is my thrust axis, if all of my three momenta were right on my thrust axis, then these two sums would be the same, and this quantity T would be one. So if one minus T is much, much less than one, then most of my radiation is sitting along this axis, and a little bit is perhaps leaking off. where this radiation could be hard along this axis. It could have a lot of energy because the total center of mass set by my E plus E minus collision has a lot of energy. And the radiation that's way off my axis is just very soft, so that it doesn't affect this sum very heavily. And once you've found the thrust axis, the expression for thrust actually simplifies. If I introduce a set of light cone coordinates, where n, comma n bar is 1 plus minus n hat, those are my light cone coordinates, then I have radiation that's collinear to the n direction. Then I have radiation, so I'll call that Pn, Pn bar, that's collinear to the m bar direction. And this is just a parametrization of the order of magnitude of each one of the components. And I have radiation which is just ultra soft, or soft. It can be, it's isotropic, but all of its momentum components is very small. And the thrust observable itself in this coordinate system, tau, it is the sum schematically, it is the sum of the small components of my n and n bar radiation. Oh, Q would just be the center of mass. So if S is the center of mass energy, then Q squared would be equal to S. Where these sums are being taken place in different hemispheres. I don't want to sum the large component in the wrong hemisphere. So this sum would be taking place in, say, this hemisphere, and this sum would be taking place in this hemisphere. And that's just how the thrust observable simplifies in these light cone coordinates. And once we've sort of parameterized the radiation that's involved, we know the physical modes of the theory, the physical on-shell modes of the theory, and so we should be able to construct an effective field theory just using these physical modes that are producing the event that I am interested in. And formally, this effective field theory is known as soft collinear effective field theory. I'm going to put a 1 there for reasons that will become obvious later. And if you look at the scaling of these modes, you find that there's a hierarchy between them in their Lorentz invariant sort of mass shell. So if I were to draw, well, this would correspond to the m bar direction, this corresponds to the n. So if you ever see me write plus or minus, I'm talking about the n or the m bar directions. I can draw an invariant mass hyperbola according to these constraints, where I would have hard radiation up here. These collinear modes sit along on a hyperbola like this, and these soft modes sit on a hyperbola even further down towards zero. And that's because this tau parameter, the thrust that I'm measuring, has been constrained to be much, much less than 1. And once I've sort of written down the effective field theory, I'll have a Lagrangian for each one of these. I'll have one for the collinear sector, the in-bar collinear sector, and one for the ultrasoft sector. And those Lagrangians will have no couplings between the sectors, so that the modes will be truly factorized the way the Lagrangian will describe the dynamics of just that sector. And they sort of will all meet together in an expression I'll write down for my observable, which is d sigma d tau, the cross section as a function of my thrust parameter. And I will have generically a matching coefficient as a standard and effective theory. Then I'll have two jet functions, which are just operators, matrix elements of operators that live in each of my two collinear directions, which are just describing the dynamics of the particular jet. And then I'll have this soft function, which describes the dynamics of my soft radiation that's sort of isotropic and everywhere. And the soft radiation is also necessary just to keep momentum conservation balanced in each hemisphere. In other words, I have this small momentum component in this hemisphere, can't be balanced by what's going on in this hemisphere that's been factorized away. And another way to think about it, the component in this hemisphere is just way too large to balance this small component. So I need the soft radiation to balance the small component of the momentum of my collinear radiation in, say, this hemisphere. And so that's sort of the role that the soft function is playing. It just sort of balances out my collinear radiation. And so now I've constructed this effective theory. I've written down sort of a schematic form of what the factorization would look like. And the whole entire reason why I went about doing this, one might ask, is that if I had sat down to calculate this cross-section in fixed order QCD, so d sigma d tau, I'm just going to calculate it fixed order in QCD. Of just a product of those. And each one of these functions is described by, has its own Lagrangian for the modes inside that operator. So there's some operator sitting inside of this J, and those operators are described by a Lagrangian that does not couple to these guys. So it's just a product. So it really is factorized like 1 times 2 times 3 is 6. Well, you don't really need the 1 when you do that type of factorization. But anyhow. But if I were to calculate it fixed order in QCD, say I would calculate the first order, I would find a alpha s times a log squared of tau, where tau is my thrust parameter, which is much, much less than 1. So this log is a large logarithm. And then if I were to calculate next order, I would find an alpha s squared times log to the fourth. And if I were to calculate the next order, I would have an alpha s cubed log to the sixth. And in fact, if you were to take that alpha s inverse is about the same order as my log of tau, you would see that my perturbation series is like I'm summing the inverse of alpha at every single stage in perturbation series. So it's not a very well-behaved, not a good perturbation series at all, because I'm effectively expanding in a large number.
Your effective thing is alpha
Oh, yeah. Squared. And this should be right. So my perturbation series is rapidly breaking down. And what this factorization theorem will allow me to do is, through just renormalization group evolution, resum all of these large logarithms. So when I write down the factorization theorem, there's some common factorization scale. That's arbitrary, where I've performed this factorization. And by arbitrary, I mean that is true. And this factorization scale in each one of those functions corresponds to ultraviolet divergences within that function. That's, if I were to calculate that function, the mu dependence would come about because this function by itself has ultraviolet divergences. I renormalize them, and in their place, I get arbitrary scale mu. And that means that each one of these functions has a renormalization group evolution. And doing that renormalization group evolution automatically resums these logarithms. And so one way that I could do it is I could use the renormalization group for my hard function, the matching coefficient. I could run it down to the jet scale. Then I could run up my ultra soft scale to the jet scale, so that now everything's meeting at this common scale mu, which is of order the jet scale, so mu squared would be q squared tau. It's arbitrary that I could, since mu by d mu of the entire cross section is zero, I could have run everything down to the ultra soft scale or everything up to the hard scale. Because it is the only scale that the jet can be sensitive to. And that is because the jet is only sensitive to its Lorentz invariant mass. I mean, that's the modes of that sector are just the Lorentz invariant quantity in that sector, I should say, is just sort of the invariant mass of the jet modes. And since the invariant mass of the jet modes go as q squared tau, then that's going to be the right scale to minimize logs in that function. You can verify that by just doing a one-loop calculation, and you would find the log with the appropriate scale.
You know, in 3D, for example, you know exactly what to do because you can see it, the one loop.
Mm-hmm. Like the soft function is just sort of the one-loop soft function.
Right.
I guess sort of in the definition of the jet function, what these are just creation of annihilation operators for a quark. Tau is sort of the measured thrust, and tau j just sort of picks up the amount of thrust that is being contributed by these by the jet. And since this tau is the only phase space constraint I have is this delta function, so tau is the only constraint being fed into the jet function, and so that you could only produce logs of tau. Is another way to think about it, because that's the only kinematic information that you feed into the jet function. So when I've done this renormalization group evolution, I will find a cross-section which schematically, with some coefficient here, that looks like this, where this L was that log, it'll look like a log Q squared over mu squared, where Q squared was the hard center of mass energy, and log twiddle is what I would call a sort of low scale log. It is a log of my thrust over my mu squared. And I've evolved to the scale mu squared that is of the same order as Q squared tau. So this log, it's like a log of two, log of three, it's not very large. This log is the large log that was spoiling my resummed perturbation series. And this form of the resummation just came out without even thinking about it. It's this large log squared came from when I ran the hard function down to the jet, which makes sense because the hard function should only know about the large logs, the hard scales. This log twiddle, the sort of a low scale log, depends on the kinematic invariant, came from evolving my low scale mode, the soft mode, to the jet scale. And it was important that it actually came in this particular form in order to guarantee mu by d mu of the cross section is zero. And what is sort of surprising here is that this piece, which if you varied mu, you would find that this piece cancels the mu variation of this piece to leading order in the log. So this piece varies to leading order in the log as alpha log, and this piece also varies as alpha log to leading order in the log because this L is much, much greater than that L twiddle. And sort of what's surprising about this is that in my low scale evolution, and at the low scales, I should know nothing about the hard physics. I've integrated that out. I have produced a log of the hard scale in my low scale evolution. And it needed to be there in this exponent to guarantee that mu by d mu of d sigma tau equals zero. And that this f of L twiddle, which are sort of the low scale matrix elements here, have no large logs in them. I don't want to factorize and have a large log in my matrix elements, because then it would just, once again, spoil my perturbation series for those individual matrix elements. Spoiling the entire reason why I did the resummation to begin with. And so, sort of through the magic of effective field theory and the renormalization group, without doing any thinking, just by writing down the correct mode, the physical modes of the theory, constrained by just momentum conservation and sort of what my observable was, I naturally got a cross-section that was mu independent. And I resummed the large logs that were spoiling my fixed-order perturbation series. And this is the story of SCET1. There are other observables where this story just breaks down horribly. And you can see very easily what type of an observable you would need in order to make my story break down. And that is any observable where my soft scale was actually at my jet scale. So for instance, say I'm colliding two protons at the LHC, and I have 10,000 inverse femtobarns of luminosity. So I actually have an extremely good measurement of the Higgs PT cross-section. And I'm measuring just the differential cross-section to produce a Higgs. So this is my beam axis. The Higgs is produced with some transverse momentum to my beam axis. And I've measured the Higgs in the detector. Okay, I want to measure the decay products of the Higgs in the detector. So I produce the Higgs with some transverse momentum. Off it comes. And the bulk of these events that will lead to Higgs production, particularly with a light Higgs, will be along with the Higgs along the beam axis, heavily boosted along the beam axis, which means that they have very small transverse momentum to the beam axis. Well, I already know two of my modes. I'll write them with hats because they're partonic modes. And these are the modes just coming from the protons themselves. And those modes just came because there's for radiation from my partonic collision that's recoiling the Higgs. And since this Higgs is constrained to have small transverse momentum, then these modes must have small transverse momentum. Where now my light cone directions are just defined by the beam axis. And then once again, momentum conservation and isotropy, in other words, a soft mode should be isotropic, and otherwise it's just constrained by momentum conservation. The scaling of my soft mode is just that. And if I were to look at the sort of invariant mass of each one of these modes, they're all of the same order. And so now when I draw my sort of invariant mass hyperbola, I have my hard mode. I will have some hard modes when I try to perform factorization. But all my other modes live on the same hyperbola. So when I do the renormalization group evolution, I will only have that hard evolution, or I could evolve all these modes up to the hard scale. Yes. And so the puzzle is this term that came from having soft modes whose virtuality was much, much less than the jet modes. They evolved up to the jet scale, gave me this term in the exponent that sort of guaranteed the mu independence of my cross-section, these ultra-soft modes aren't there anymore. And so if I just ran in my invariant mass, or I did the normal sort of dim reg style RG, I would only sum these hard logs. And I would find that my cross section is mu dependent, if this is all I did. Well, no, it's not. Well, if I were to make the demand that whatever low-scale matrix elements I calculated have no large logs in it, and I just did that hard running, then I would have an exponent alpha log squared f l twiddle. And when I do sort of the variation in mu of this, the leading order variation is going to go in this exponent as alpha log. And there's no other term in this exponent to subtract off that alpha log variation. Ah, because I don't want to have any large logs in my low-scale matrix element.
If you do it, the problem is it's not clear out because of the logs in there.
Yes.
Mu dependence is not, you know that the physical answer
does not. You know that the physical answer is not, yes, you know that the physical answer cannot depend on mu. That is absolutely true. The question is have I constructed have I done the effective theory right? It's not that the physics depends on mu. It's that, have I been intelligent about how I construct my effective theory? And sort of what I'm getting at is, earlier I could have just been lazy. I didn't have to think about it. Now, it's going to require a bit more thought on my part. And the fact that this soft mode is sitting on the same hyperbola as my jet modes also means that the factorization between those, sort of the effective theory, the factorization between those modes that give me my effective theory can't be in just the invariant mass. In other words, the modes aren't differentiated by their invariant mass. So there's going to be, in my factorization, in my effective theory, a further type of cutoff I need to put in there, if we want to think about this in a Wilsonian sense. The cutoff just can't be in the invariant mass, sort of as your classical Wilsonian picture. I'm going to need a cutoff in these sort of rapidity or light cone directions. So what differentiates the soft mode is just the amount of rapidity it has. And so this sort of then comes to the actual title of my talk, Rapidity Divergences. And just like in a Wilsonian RG, or a Wilsonian sense, when you factorize and you differentiate modes by their invariant mass, you get ultraviolet divergences. When you differentiate modes in their rapidity, you get rapidity divergences. But these rapidity divergences cannot be regularized or by sort of your classic dim reg. You are going to need a further further regulator in order to get a handle on these rapidity divergences. And the short answer why that's true is that when we do classic dim reg, we analytically continue the transverse directions. But the factorization I need to the transverse directions to my physical four momenta, which would be analytically continuing in my perps. But the directions that I need to regulate are the in and in bar directions, the collinear directions. And sort of illustrate at one loop how this happens is that we could construct in the soft approximation sort of how the soft radiation would recoil the Higgs. So in the soft approximation, I'll get an iconal propagator, which would just be whatever hard jet. I'll have two iconal propagators, each one from the hard jets, and I have some soft radiation recoiling off of them. So this n dot k would be an iconal propagator from one of the jets, and bar dot k would be another one. I have the transverse momentum of the Higgs. That's the transverse momentum of the soft radiation that's recoiling the Higgs. And the transverse momentum itself is on shell. And sort of the schematic Feynman diagram for this is this, where this line right here is one of my jet directions. This line right here is my other jet direction. Here's the soft radiation crossing the cut that's recoiling the Higgs. And if one were to just naively calculate this integral only in dim reg, you would first find an overall factor that goes like mu squared to the 2 epsilon plus divided by pt squared to the 1 plus 2 epsilon. All multiplied by an integral that looks like that, where this is an integral over sort of the rapidity of the soft radiation. And this integral is just ill-defined as it stands. And that actually makes sense that I would run into this sort of ill-defined integral because I need to differentiate my soft modes and the ill-defined integral specifically over sort of the light cone momenta. Because I need to differentiate these soft modes from my jet modes. And the only way to do that is in sort of the light cone directions. And so the presence of this ill-defined integral, and it's only ill-defined because I haven't put a regulator in there yet, is just a consequence of the fact that I need to define my soft sector by further factorizing in sort of the rapidity directions. And in solving this sort of new, needing to put in this new regulator in those light cone directions will also lead to the answer of how to get that mu independent cross section that physically we knew had to be there. So the type of regulator that you want to use. How am I doing on time? Okay. The type of regulator that you want to use, you want to sort of satisfy properties that are, well, I guess you want to satisfy physical properties. You want it to be gauge invariant. You would like it to preserve sort of exponentiation. And exponentiation is just the statement of that the soft radiation, which is just radiation off of classical currents, has a much more simplified expansion than just sort of your naive loop expansion. In QED, it's the statement that any soft function is just one loop exact if I have no fermions. And the idea is, if I have some complicated whole bunch of soft radiation going off of these Iconal lines, and I sum over that, it'll just simplify into just one Feynman diagram in the exponent. And that's just a that's just a combinatorial fact. And lastly, any divergences that you get from it, you want to be able to renormalize. And once you renormalize the divergences, you want to be able to write down some type of Archie. And my collaborators and I have come up with a scheme to do precisely these things. My collaborators being Ira Rothstein, Ju Yu, Chiyu, and Ambar Jain. We're all at Carnegie Mellon. And how the regularization proceeds is that I regulate the, in this integral, at one loop, the K3 component of the momentum. And the K3 component of the momenta in the light cone coordinates is just that. And this will provide for me an effective cutoff in the rapidity integration. And it's, you can kind of think of it as sort of a further dimensional continuum, a further dim reg in my longitudinal components, not just in my transverse components. And putting in this regulator I can now calculate that integral because it puts in this further factor. And once I calculate that, I'll get an expression that schematically looks like so. And with this further divergence, I get this further divergence, and then one can just write down it for my soft function, my bare soft function. You can write down a z factor which will just absorb that extra rapidity divergence. And this extra parameter nu that I wrote in is, as an analogy to Dimrag, I just want to keep sort of the dimensions of my integral the same. So I need to put in another mass parameter in order to keep the dimensions of the integral the same. I can write down a z factor, which will absorb up all of the rapidity divergences that were in my bare soft function when I naively calculated it. And for my two jet sectors, you will also find similar rapidity divergences. And you can write down these z factors to absorb these rapidity divergences. And what one would find is that in the product of all of these sectors, the rapidity divergences cancel, which makes sense because they're not a physical thing. They're just an artifact of the effective theory that I wrote down. But since I can renormalize them out of each one of the sectors, that allows me to write down a further renormalization group evolution in each one of those sectors. And so that I will trade this rapidity divergence for an arbitrary parameter in my renormalized function. And then once I have that arbitrary parameter in my renormalized function, I can write down an RG equation in that parameter. And it is in solving this rapidity renormalization group that then will restore the invariant, will give me that term in the exponential I needed to make my cross section mu independent. So So I guess sort of the take-home message is that one can, when faced with a sort of a factorization where you have modes that have the same invariant mass, they all lie on the same invariant mass hyperbola, that sort of your traditional techniques of factorization break down, and that you can do a further factorization in the rapidity directions, where once you've done the renormalization group evolution, you get the mu independent cross section, and this sort of set of techniques open up a whole entire new class of problems for an effective field theory approach to sort of tackle and resum that I hitherto have just been not amiable to an effective theory approach. So I guess I'll conclude on that.
Go ahead.
I have a visual. So that approach is SAT sub 2 then?
Yes.
So physically, I mean, the motivation for this was that you want to break away from any directions, mm-hmm. hyperbole. But your other motivation was you were sort of fishing around for where the soft and jet functions could get a log pt squared over mu squared in their beta functions, respectively. Right? Something to cancel the big L.
Yeah.
In the RG evolution of the hard function.
Yeah.
So where do I see that kind of dependence coming out in here?
Yeah. So
there's obviously large logs in nu that cancel among each other.
There are large logs in nu that cancel amongst each other.
But where's the pt squared over mu squared dependence coming from? It's q squared over mu squared.
Yeah. You would want some type of q squared
over
mu squared to get that large logs. And that's coming in from the jet sector. And that's because when I've done this further regularization in the rapidity, so in the jet sector, let's look at the say this would be something like a transverse momentum PDF. So in my PDF, I have my Altarelli-Parisi splitting function. Right. And this Altarelli-Parisi splitting function has some term in it that's going like 1 minus z. And if you were to look up in a textbook, they would always write it with a little plus there, just saying that we've regulated this 1 minus z as z goes to 1. And in a PDF, you can choose any regulator that you want, regulate this 1 minus z, and you would find that between the real and the virtual corrections, that divergence as z goes to 1 goes away. In the transverse momentum PDF, it doesn't go away because it's being multiplied by this 1 over pt squared. No virtual correction can cancel it because all virtual corrections have 0 pt. So in the jet sector, when you put in a regulator, you'll induce a dependence in the jet energy.
Okay.
And this 1 minus z term in your Altarelli-Parisi splitting function will get modified to look something like this. And that's just because in the jet sector, when I regulate the K3 momenta, or the K parallel momenta of the jet, since
that's starting out of order Q.
Right? This guy is just order Q. I can forget about this because it's a small component.
Okay.
And then this will eventually produce the log Q over nu, which is the large log that I wanted to resum. And it's getting multiplied by this mu squared over pt squared. So it's eventually also going to get multiplied by some log mu squared over pt squared, which is exactly the type of structure I wanted to see, the L twiddle, in the exponent. So when I do the nu evolution in this parameter, I'll get in that exponent this L twiddle term.
Right, although we want to see it in a mu evolution. But I guess somewhere there's probably also like log mu over nus.
There are log mu's over nus that are coming from the soft function.
When you add those together, the mu over nu is from the soft function, the q over nu is.
Yeah.
You end up with the q over nu.
Yeah.
When you do the regular RG, assuming you do it by matching some causes of the energy.
Yeah.
But now you have iterated, you get an additional physical observable to measure.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Well, what sort of the observable that you would match to is that you know the, in fixed order, you would know the PT spectrum at some fixed order in your loop calculation. And you know that the sum at fixed order between your jets and your soft should reproduce that fixed order that fixed order result. And there, you can think about it that, so I have my fixed order result in one over, in PT, and then I have my jet plus soft has to equal the fixed order. And in the rapidity RG, it's these jet functions which are acting like my matching coefficients. And that's just because they're at the higher scale and rapidity compared to my soft. But by seeing that this fixed scale is reproduced by my jet plus soft, then once I've picked a scheme, I can assign terms to everybody in an unambiguous way.